This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. I don't know how many times I have to talk about this, but it's so important. If you're sitting there right now and you're stressed or you're anxious or you have a lot on your mind and you just bottle it up and you don't know what to do, it's going to come out, and it's not going to come out in great ways all the time. BetterHelp has helped me substantially. Ryan here has been using it for a while. And I, you know, don't you notice when you don't use BetterHelp? When you don't have therapy?
Oh, the weeks where I miss a session? Of course, yeah.
Yeah, it's just, it's like, the more you talk about something, even if you don't think you have anything to talk about, things come up, and it puts your mind at ease. And we all carry around different stressors, you know, big and small. And at times, we keep carrying them around rather than processing them and letting them go. When we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively.
Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down.
Therapy from BetterHelp is helpful for learning positive coping skills and how to set boundaries. It empowers you to be the best version of yourself. It isn't just for those who've experienced major trauma. It's for all of us. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist, and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. I think people think, oh, what if I don't like my therapist? If you don't, you switch them. It's that easy. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/inside today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/inside.
What's up, everyone? It's Reality Steve, your number one source for all things Bachelor Nation and reality TV. Every day, I'm giving you the behind-the-scenes juice and your info on all your Bachelor Nation stories, and also interviewing some of your favorite reality stars. My name has been synonymous with spoilers, but I'm so much more than that. Give me a listen.
The Reality Steve Podcast, part of the Believe Network. Just search BLEAV on YouTube or wherever you listen.
You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum. It is Supernatural Week. I just want to throw a few things at you. In Love with Michael Rosenbaum, Chris Sullivan is also an iTunes subscribe. Write a review. Chris Sullivan and I really appreciate you. October 18th, I'll be signing with Tom Welling in Columbus, Madison, Wisconsin on the 25th, November 8th in Austin. Germany, my band Left on Laurel will be playing. Our album's out, man. You can pre-order it right now on iTunes. Go to the iTunes store and pre-order the album. If not, on the 4th, which is this Friday, it's coming out on all platforms. And merch, you can find it on Inside of You store and all that. We're really excited. And at the end of this episode, I'm going to play a song. Yesterday, we played a song after the Mark Shepherd one. But today, we're going to play one after this lovely guest. We're going to play the second track on the Left on Laurel debut album, Saved by the Ground. Right now, Misha Collins, boy, is this guy handsome. He is just a handsome son of a bee. He's 45, too. I look at him, I'm like, why can't I look like that at 47? I guess because I'm 47. But we really get into it. He's very open. I mean, he seems like a shy person. He is shy, but he's really sweet and fun. He's been on everything. I mean, the guy was on Charmed, NYPD Blue. He's been on CSI Crime and Scene Investigation. What else? I mean, he's in a lot of these procedurals. And then landed Supernatural. And I think that really changed his life. And he loves you fans. So listen to him talk about that. Let's get inside Misha Collins.
It's my point of view. You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum.
Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum was not recorded in front of a live studio audience.
Are you hearing me now?
Yeah, perfectly.
Okay.
You actually sound really clear. There's no echo. You look good. It's good lighting.
I've been working on sounding good the computer microphone.
Do you do vocal warm-ups before your Skype calls?
Yeah, but only for about 45 minutes.
Well, dude, good to see you. This is pretty exciting, Misha. I've been wanting to get you on the podcast for a while now.
Making the mistake for a while of trying to do it in person, and our paths weren't crossing frequently enough. So this is a wise choice.
This is a wise choice. It's just very difficult for me to get up to Vancouver, but more so for you to leave Vancouver.
It's true, because of my contract that forbids me from leaving Vancouver.
Is that true? Was it a 10-year contract?
It's a 10-year contract, and they have a low jack on me. And if I cross the border, explode and sever my foot. So,
how many interviews do you do a year, you think?
I think we do a lot fewer interviews in the last 5 or 6 years than previously. When the show was newer, when Supernatural was still something that people were excited about, we were doing quite a few interviews. But then it was like, well, this show has been around forever and nothing has changed. And the guys that are on the show are quite old now and not interesting. They stopped.
You're a liar.
And now what we have, it's kind of exciting, is the end of the show. And so everyone is like, oh, finally, it's over. Let's talk to them about that. So I think that this year is going to be a year of a lot of interviews.
Yeah.
And probably this will be the last time anyone wants to talk to us. So we'll, I'm sure, really soak this up.
You really, your dry sense of humor, it actually... I was thinking, oh my God, he really believes this for a second.
He really
feels like he's washed up. And I'm like, he's crazy. Do you ever go to these conventions? Rob, have you ever been? Rob's here. Rob Hollis, my engineer / producer. Rob, say hi.
Hello.
He's never seen Supernatural.
If I crane my head off to my left.
Yeah, that wouldn't help at all.
I still can't see you. It's not like looking through a window.
That's Rob. Let's not get too comfortable looking at Rob, though. I just wanted you to see him.
My wife watched Supernatural.
Well, it is. Would you say it's mostly women who watch the show? Do you have, I mean, if you had a percentage?
No, I don't think so. I think it's mostly women who are super fans of the show, but it's a pretty good demographic mix of people who watch the show. So that's actually, yeah, they're two really separate demographics. The people who just watch the show and the people who love the show. For some reason, it's a show that appeals, you know, to really enthusiastic female fans. But we get tons of guys who are like, you know, our entire barracks in the Marines watches Supernatural every week. So it's not a one gender show. But women who are unsatisfied in the bedroom often watch our show.
Like, awesome.
They're unsatisfied in the bedroom.
That's why she stopped watching.
Very good, Rob. Good one-liner. Misha, like, look, obviously, I said Misha, like, look. You notice that? Did you hear that? That wasn't great English. I still haven't woken up yet.
Well, I have a Misha-like look, so maybe
Misha-like look? You do have a Misha-like look. I didn't want to talk, obviously, all about Supernatural, because that's not what the show is. The show's not like, you know, we're going to do a Supernatural week, which would be great, because, you know, you're all loved, but... You know, I find your story fascinating. By the way, where did we meet? Didn't we meet playing music together, or you were playing music and I got on stage? Wasn't it at one of those events? Where was it?
Well, maybe I was on stage briefly, but you're friends with Rob Benedict, right?
Yes, Rob Benedict, Jensen, Jared. I mean, I was, you know, Jensen was obviously on Smallville years ago, and that's how we became friends.
I think it was a night that you were there when Rob and his band were up on stage, and I popped up on stage briefly. We had a brief but very exhilarating encounter.
Right. It was. I liked you.
Now I think you're thinking about somebody else.
No, it was you. I was like, that guy's really cool. He's really handsome. And by the way, I hear from so many people how great you are to work with. And not only that, but you're like incredibly philanthropic, along with being a good actor and all this other crap. But I mean, that's what I noticed mostly is like, I'm like, wow, he does so much for the world, so much for people. Am I right there?
Yeah, that's me. I'm blushing right now, so I feel uncomfortable. So thank you for that. I guess that, you know, one of the good thing I think that I always wanted to, when I grew up, be a net positive on the world. And I thought for a long time that I was going to go into politics.
Yeah, you worked in the Clinton administration or not Clinton administration?
Yeah, I was an intern for Bill Clinton. And I don't know that I did much work, but I was there.
That's good. You were there.
Yeah. And but that experience kind of disillusioned me with politics. I thought, oh, maybe this isn't the right path for me to take.
What was it about that?
There were a couple of factors that went into it. You know, I was in the White House, and I guess I had imagined that being in the White House, you were going to be in this space where the best and the brightest minds in America and frankly the world were all under one roof. I mean, now we can very clearly laugh at that concept. But I think at the time, there were probably a lot of people who thought that. And then when I got there, I discovered, oh, it's actually kind of, it's a lot of, it actually made sense. There were a lot of yay-sayers, a lot of people who were just going to toe the line and like whatever the president wanted, the president got.
Right.
And it was a team that was there to support him. But what that meant was, there's a lot of people who had volunteered on the campaign countless hours. They got positions in the White House, or people whose parents donated a lot of money to the campaign. They got positions in the White House. I'm not talking about like cabinet level positions, but there are, you know, thousands of people that work below that, that are presidential appointees. And it was just like kind of a lot of nepotism and not the brightest people in the world and not the most engaging place. And I was like, I don't want to deal with this.
But you could have made a difference. You were seeing it from the inside, or maybe that's what you thought. You thought, I actually can't make a difference. It's almost impossible to make a difference in here.
Well, I guess I thought, well, you know what, I'll start, you know, working for politicians and I'll find a way to work my way up and, you know, learn the ropes. And then I decided I would, my plan B was, all right, maybe I'll just get famous enough that I can make a difference that way. I gave myself 5 years, and 5 years later, I like could barely get a guest spot on Charmed.
But you got it.
But I got it. And then I sort of gave up on politics. And then ironically, Trump came along and it rekindled something in me. And I felt like, all right, maybe I will, you know, dive back into that world in a bigger way. I don't know that I'll ever run for office, but I want to be, you know, much more politically active.
Well, you and Jensen, the three of you really supported Beto.
You're not a Trump supporter. That's not what you meant.
Oh, no, no, no. I'm sorry if I misled you. No, I love Trump.
We don't get political here, but I'm very interested. I was very interested in how that all happened. And like, so you sort of are inspired now to actually make a difference. You're going back on what you had thought years ago. And you know what? I'm going to do whatever I can now with whatever little power I have or whatever power and try to make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. Now, you grew up poor.
That's true.
Yeah, because, you know, I always, when I read about that, like poor as in homeless at times?
Yeah, homeless at times and on welfare at times and on food stamps for a long time. And, you know, raised by a single mom for the most part. I visited my dad. He was, you know, he was a satellite in our childhood.
Meaning he wasn't around. He just kind of came in and out.
We saw him like once, you know, a weekend, two weekends a month kind of thing. But he wasn't, you know, really a presence in my upbringing. My childhood was interesting because on the one hand, it was full of adventure and, you know, living in tents and learning that you don't need money to feel happy or loved. But at the same time, there was a lot of struggle and a lot of difficulty because of that and a lot of, you know, not fitting in and a lot of, I guess, embarrassment about being really poor.
How old are you at this point?
Well, my parents split up when I was three and we were living in pretty impoverished circumstances starting when I was five, I would say. Yeah, and we moved schools, you know, more often than once a year, which actually made it really hard because I never had a peer group and I was always sort of the new kid and the weird kid. So I learned some like coping skills, but it was also challenging and I probably have some emotional scar tissue from the experience.
Well, I want to get into the scar tissue, but when you say homeless, I mean, you know, I'm thinking, you know, living under a bridge in a tent. Are you talking shelters? Are you talking a little bit of all of that?
No, I mean, we only went to a shelter when we were living in a tent and a hurricane came, but we were living in tents here and there, and we were living in subsidized housing that was pretty pretty bad, and a cabin that had an outhouse for a little while, and a windowless office space that didn't have a shower or a kitchen for a while. So it was like sort of patchwork. But, you know, I mean, as a kid, kids are, you know, incredibly resilient and can deal with a lot of things. And luckily I had my mom was incredibly present and incredibly loving. We just were super poor. But now that I have kids, I see, oh, wow, that must have been harder on me than I thought.
Yeah. I honestly just can't imagine. I keep thinking about this little boy, you know, living in a tent. And I think, I mean, do you think back, like, can you remember anything specifically when you go back and you, you know, I don't know if you've done any psychotherapy, but I'm about to dive into that shit soon. But I'm thinking, do you think of anything that you thought maybe as a 5-year-old, 6-year-old, whatever, little boy going, wow, this, I hope it gets better than this. Like, this is like, I'm scared. Do you remember feeling scared? Do you remember feeling, who are these people, or any encounters with other people who were, you know, dangerous, or seeing anything that you kind of like blocked out that remember now?
That's a really interesting question. I'm going to take a step back and just, and say that for the longest time, all the way probably until my mid to late 20s, I painted my childhood really heroically. Like, all of the things that I experienced as a kid, hitchhiking, literally, you know, your grandparents say, you know, when I was a kid, I used to walk, you know, 10 miles through snow to school. And I used to like walk, you know, when I was 7 years old, I would walk 2 miles through the woods on a little path with my 4.5-year-old brother in tow, you know, by ourselves in the snow. And I felt like that built character and made me stronger and made me not afraid of the world. And my mother had this incredible irreverence. She really was always about like bucking convention and not having us cow to cultural norms. And I really painted that heroically. And then later, it was like maybe my late 20s, early 30s, I started to reassess it and realize that some of those things were difficult. Like we would, you know, at times not have a car, and we would hitchhike, and there would be, you know, men who would try to, you know, pay my mother for sex. And
do you remember that?
Yeah. And I remember like times, you know, feeling, you know, my mom would buck conventions, but for example, one of them was she cut my hair to look like a girl. I had short bangs and long flowing hair, and she painted my my fingernails and my toes with nail polish and sent me off at 4 years old to Cub Scouts in a very rough, very working class town where I was really abused by my peers.
Why did she do that?
You know, I think that she was like, you know, boys should be able to dress like girls. And I mean, now in this modern moment, it's so much more culturally acceptable and it's so much easier to do something like that. But at the time, like, I was really eviscerated by my peers, and it was really hard. And it wasn't something that I was choosing for myself. It was something that she was choosing for me. And that was hard. And there were these little sort of alienating moments throughout my childhood that were challenging. And, you know, at the same time, in some way, they built characters. So it was a two-sided coin, I guess.
Yeah. Well, look,
this really is therapy. I'm gonna cry.
No, I mean, believe it or not, the fan base or the listeners that listen in, it's not that we like we want to get dirt, and that's not what it is. For me, it's like it's more about your journey, Misha. It's more about, I look at this amazing human being who I admire and I'd change places with you. I'm working on myself and trying to be a better person. And I look at like, hey, you just haven't always been this strong, solid guy who's always, you know, faced adversity and, you know, I feel like knowing this, I want to see the character and how you survive. Because like, I remember, you know, my mother, certain things, like, you know, she helped me dress up. It was her idea for me to dress up like Pat Benatar in a very conservative town to get extra credit for a class. And I sang Shadows of the Night, and she put breasts and lipstick and all this stuff on me. And I remember an entire classroom looked at me like, You're who the fuck is this? And I remember looking at them and this buzzing feeling got over me. Like, I guess that was anxiety then. And it was like, oh my gosh, you are failing right now. You are failing. And I just remember leaving the room in full drag thinking, oh my God, I thought that was going to be so funny and I was going to be embraced. But, you know, I had a say in that. I said, yeah, this is going to be funny. And my mom helped me. She didn't force me to dress like a woman or a girl. So what I'm saying is, when I hear that, does that make you, years later, did you suddenly say, did you ever say, Mom, why would you do that when I didn't ask for it?
I don't know that I've ever confronted her on it. And it's a funny thing because I think that we should live in a world where that isn't a painful experience for a kid. Like, I think that this should be a place where you can dress however you want, you can present however you want, you can, you know, have you can love whoever you want, you can be whoever you want and not be ridiculed for it. And if somebody does ridicule you, fuck them. However,
I agree with you, by the way.
That wasn't the case, and it was difficult. And I think that there were moments when sort of her philosophical framework was preempting my developmental needs. I guess I have, you know, had conversations with her about that. You know, another one that was really challenging for me was she really wanted me and my younger brother to be politically aware and connected to the importance of justice and peace, I guess. But one of the casualties of that was that she was talking about nuclear war all the time and like taking us to nuclear Holocaust films at a young age. And I had like terrible nightmares about that for the longest time. So as I'm starting to parent, I'm trying to strike a balance where trying to make my kids aware politically, but not traumatize them. We have a big homeless population a few blocks from our house. And I always try to make the kids walk with me, you know, on the sidewalk where everybody is camped out, so that they develop the sense that these are just people. And that actually they're often very friendly people who they can feel like are part of their community and not an alien other. But at the same time, I'm also really being careful not to show them movies where everyone is burned into fiery ash.
Sure. Did you tell them like, hey, daddy was homeless?
Yeah. Although I don't know if that's really settled in with them yet.
And that's got to be kind of like, how old are they?
6 and 8.
So it's hard to sort of comprehend, right? Because obviously you live such a, you know, the lifestyle that's so different from that now. It's just crazy. It's crazy to hear, you know, the story in it. It is. I agree with you 100%. I don't know how anyone can't agree with you. When was it where you finally were able to move into an apartment, move into a house? Things started to get better. You saw a light at the end of the tunnel. When was it that you said, okay, hey, this is, because it seems like even incrementally, like every, you were so far down in terms of homelessness and all these things. And, you know, your dad and the relationship with them. And all of a sudden now you can only look up at this point, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess I was never really thinking of our situation as terribly dire. And I think that maybe that was because I was, you know, growing up in a relatively poor town where there were a lot of other kids who were in struggling situations. I do remember being, you know, a little bit embarrassed about having other kids, you know, come over to our windowless office, or, you know, I never brought friends home to the tent. I think that my not feeling like I fit in made me work extra hard so that I could, you know, impress my teachers or find some sort of a touchstone where I was like, well, I'm good at this, so you can't criticize me for this. And so, you know, I did well in school from a young age and, you know, went to a good high school and went to a good college. And I carved out a little avenue for myself to be successful at, I guess, so that I could feel good about myself. I also worked hard, and maybe that was, I think, you know, looking back, I think that that was some sort of compensation too.
Yeah. And you say your mom was loving. Was she always one to say, I love you and you're going to be something big and I support you whenever you do? And there was always that feeling of I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, I could do whatever there is I want to do. And you think that also helped you really get through it? Because if she wasn't, not having your father there as present, it's really up to your mother. And if she wasn't there, who knows where you'd be right now?
Yeah, no, my mom, I mean, that was like a real gift that my mother gave me. She believed in me. She never really questioned what I was doing. She was always supportive. You know, like if you go into the field of acting, it could be really challenging if you're coming from a family that thinks that you're making a foolish decision. When you decided to become an entertainer, did you have support?
Not really. I think my mother she's pretty eccentric and she was just kind of like, yeah, whatever. I did theater. But like, she didn't really care. My father was definitely like, you know, he worked in a pharmaceutical company. He's very bright, like 1420 in his SATs when the 1600 was the highest. And I wasn't anything like him, which I felt like you know, I could not get his approval because I was so different. So, yeah, I remember being at Denny's after a play and I'm like, I'm going to be an actor. And he's like, eat your steak. And that was, you know, that was sort of it. And he just never, and it wasn't until, you know, it just took a long time before he ever sort of, I think it was like, it was actually Smallville that he probably said, I don't think he ever said, hey, you're really good. I never heard that. But I think it was like, hey, I need some pictures to give to my employees. That, and I felt like, oh, wow, he wants some pictures of me. That, to me, was the most I was going to get. It wasn't like, you're so goddamn good. You're the best Lex ever. I never heard any of that shit. But, you know.
That's high praise, though. That's
it was
high
like,
praise.
For me, yeah. So, yeah, I didn't get that sort of approval. I always talk about this, you know, ad nauseum, that, you know, for children, especially in their developmental stages, and your proof's in the pudding. I mean, you know, for some kid who was living in a tent and homeless to make it to where you have, it says a lot about your mom. It says a lot about the love and support you got, and, you know, and shows and your strength. Now, I'm not going to give her all of it, but, like, you know, you had this inner strength that you said, hey, I'm going to fight this, and I'm going to be the best that I can.
Yeah, I think it was definitely both, but I think that it's really important for a parent to just sort of shower their children in unconditional love and support and say, I believe, you know, I trust you to make the right choices. And I mean, you know, that's not, you can't paint with too broad a brush on that, because at some points you have to sort of carefully redirect your children. But that support was really, really helpful. It would be just like swimming upstream if you're fighting against parents who don't want you to, you know, pursue that kind of thing.
Right. And many people go through that. I mean, it's a dumb question. I always ask this question. This is not the first time I'm asking, but do you get anxiety? Do you get depression? Do you get like, I can't do this, I have fear in the way? Or are you someone who, because I know you like do crazy meditation, you go on retreats every year. Do you still do the retreats 10 days a year for yourself?
Since my children were born, I have not been doing a 10-day retreat every year, but I just got back from one last week and it was great. I was like, oh, I missed this so much. So
what happens on these retreats? I mean, in a nutshell.
It's always something different, but you spend 10 days in silence. You spend 13.
Hang on. You can't just do that because you're talking to someone who can't be silent for 10 seconds.
Well, I think anyone can actually do it. I think that the silence is the easy part. It's the sitting on a cushion and meditating 13 hours a day that is crazy making. And you go through a lot. You go on a psychic and spiritual journey that's very challenging at times. But I invariably come out the other side just feeling like I've had major epiphanies and feeling much more grounded and happy and present. So I think it's a really useful tool for me. I don't know where I'd be without it. It helps, frankly, mitigate depression and anxiety quite a bit. I haven't suffered terribly in my life from anxiety. I'll have moments of anxiety, or, you know, sometimes at night when something's really bothering me, I can sort of loop on something or ruminate too much while I'm lying in bed. But anxiety is not crippling for me at all. And I go through this thing that I call molting once every few years, which is, frankly, I think any mental health professional would call it depression. But I just, you know, go through a period of feeling quite depressed, and it's often not connected with any story. It's not like,
it's just situational.
Well, I would say, or it's just internal, like maybe it's some sort of a cyclical chemical process. Because it is cyclical, and because it usually lasts like 2 or 3 weeks for me, I have called it molting, like shedding something, because it feels like I just kind of want to curl up in bed and not talk to anybody and not do anything for a couple of weeks. But when I say it's not connected to a story, it's not like, well, this thing happened in my life that precipitated this feeling, or if I had gotten that gig, things would be great, but I didn't, so now I'm morose. Instead, it's just, I just feel shitty.
So you welcome it as this is part of your physiological, biological.
I try to, and when it comes, I try not to fight it. I try to just let it be. But it's a challenging phase, and it's I'm in some ways grateful that I've had these periods because it allows me to have a little bit of empathy for people who struggle with depression chronically, because when I'm in that state, I feel like I am dysfunctional, like I really couldn't do anything if I wanted to, and I can't imagine that being a chronic state.
I imagine just now, like your wife walking in just now going, what the fuck are you talking about?
Talking publicly about this, you're embarrassing me.
I'm Why are you getting so deep? Don't they want to know about episode 340? What are you doing, dude?
Great episode.
Hey, by the way, look, I really appreciate you talking about this. I don't know, it just means a lot. By the way, I just watched this documentary. Have you ever tried ayahuasca or LSD or anything?
It's been a very long time since I did hallucinogenics. Ayahuasca, when I was in high school, I had, a phase of experimentation, and I did acid. I don't know when it was, long time ago. I know a lot of people who've done ayahuasca and not really ever fully come back. So that trend,
really,
yeah.
So it's dangerous if you OD, so to speak.
Well, I don't know that it's an OD thing. It's just people sort of, they come back from a 10-day trip in Peru and never the
Peru.
Same. And I don't know. So anyway, that one scares me. I'm not eager to do ayahuasca.
Well, I was watching a documentary last night called Becoming Cary Grant.
Uh-huh.
And Cary Grant, who's, one of the great actors and movie stars of our time, or of all time.
Or of another time.
Another time, of all time, actually. But he talked about how he sort of like, I guess, childhood trauma and this and that. And he went on to say that he, through an ex-girlfriend or ex-wife, actually, he experimented in LSD and then went to this psychiatrist who he would be, he put on an eye mask and he would just trip balls on LSD. And he'd sit there and he'd be like curled up in a ball going, oh God. Oh my God. And he would go on these trips that just opened his mind so much that it changed his attitude towards life. His he felt more alive. He felt more humane. His relationships with people were better. And he swears by it that LSD did this, because if not, he was not living this happy life that everybody thought he was living. He couldn't get close in his relationships. He didn't feel like he could love. He didn't feel, and he swears. We watched this last night. And we were thinking, Cary Grant. You look at these beautiful, people, and how could they be so down? And so my point was, did you find anything that was freeing about it that opened your eyes to other things that kind of made you look at the world in a different way?
I've definitely had drug experiences that have precipitated epiphany. I read this book last year called Stealing Fire, and it's sort of about this burgeoning movement of microdosing and IO hacking and the combination of, occasional drug use and meditation and, the right kind of intense exercise. And it's like there's a, whole, I mean, these people, the people that wrote the book Stealing Fire have set up labs at, Google campus for, people to come in and, experiment with these things. Not that they're microdosing people as a matter of corporate force at Google, but I think, all over Silicon Valley, that's a trend right now. And it is something that I think can expand your mind. It is also a field in which you have to be really careful, because if you, do too much or do it too often, it can totally derail your life. And maybe that's what I noticed with the people who I know who were doing ayahuasca. The ones that came back and never really seemed like themselves again were the ones that, went a second and third and fourth time, or were doing ayahuasca, twice a month, because they were trying to like chase
that high or that feeling.
So, yeah, I mean, I guess I'm all for careful and guided experimentation.
I did this. I just did this ketamine treatment. I haven't really talked about it, but there's this facility, and real doctors, they talk to you and see if you're even like a candidate. Like, hey, could this help you? And the doctor's like, yeah, I think this can help you. And I was like, look, I don't trip. I've never tripped. I've never been a drug user. I mean, you know, I've been dealing with all this stuff. And they're like, you know, I think you'd benefit. And then so I went to this clinic, and they sit you in this chair, and it's very calming. In fact, the people in the waiting room, I'm like, hey, man, have you done this before? Oh, yeah. And I'm like, cool. Does it work? He's like, it's incredible. I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, it's just really profoundly worked on me. And then you look over to this girl who's just looking at a magazine. I'm like, you too? Oh, yeah. And I'm like, okay. So I feel comfortable. And I walk in because I'm freaking out because I'm not the guy who's like, if you hand a piece of acid, or what do you call it, a piece of acid, a hit of acid, a piece.
Come on, man. Come on. Get your jargon.
I've never done acid. But
it's a tab. It's a tab of acid.
A tab of acid. So I go into this room, and I sit in this chair, and they pull me back, you know, in the chair, and we're watching you, 100% monitoring you. We've got cameras on you, so we're not going to upload these to the internet or anything. Don't worry about that. And we're just going to make, if you have any issues, you wave your hand, we're going to come in, and we're going to make you feel comfortable. And here's some blankets, and here's some headphones that the doctor sort of talked about, the music that's going to be on them, which is sort of classical. And they go, hey, we're going to give you a little IV of Ativan to just calm you, to make sure you're calm, and a little stuff for nausea. You sit back and
enjoy the show.
That's sort of what he said. Enjoy the show. And so I close my eyes and I put this little mask over me. I, of course, had all this. I was apprehensive. I was, you know, and I go, listen, whatever dose you normally give people, give me half of that because I honestly am a lightweight. So they did. And I did a couple sessions. And the first session, I could feel like, there's just this smile on my face. I had this nice warm smile. At one point I was playing piano with the music, you know, I felt like I was directing this movie. And what it did was for me, it sort of let me step out of my mind that doesn't stop running. And it took me away from all these things that weren't that important and sort of brought me into this new world where it opened me up a little bit. And so can I say, oh my God, it's worked wonders. I think gradually, like you say, like you call microdosing, I felt like it is helping me a little bit. It's sort of as long as it's a controlled environment and a professional, you know, for me, it did. For some people, I think it does. For those people, Bob and the girl out there, they're happy as clams. And, you know, whatever it takes. I mean, I look at these. I think as I'm getting older, I just feel like I'm always in control of everything. I got to be in control of this. I got to be in charge of this. I got to, you know, tell Rob, do we do this? And I need to just fucking chill the fuck out and get out of my mind. And so for me, I think it was imperative that I try something like this, as long as it wasn't dangerous or it wasn't going to kill me, which, so anyway, have I educated you at all on ketamine?
Yes, thank you. Ketamine is also, it's a dissociative, so you can see yourself from a distance if you do enough of it. Just kind of a crazy thing to think about. Like you could watch yourself. I remember being at a party about 20 years ago where it was in a motel and everyone was doing ketamine. And there was these two women that were trying to, it was this like shitty motel room. And there was a really cheesy, cheap print of a bad painting on the wall. And they were trying to crawl into the painting.
All right, by the way, this ketamine that you're talking about, the party drug, the Special K or whatever, is wildly different than what I'm doing. They say that even on the thing, they say this is controlled microdose. It's like I read the article about it, and it's like people think, oh, he's doing ketamine. He's doing this massive drug, and it's not. It gets a bad rap, you know, but that's a wild story. They're just trying to climb into it. I don't ever want to get that far.
You should ask them to up the dose just to the point where you try to crawl into a two-dimensional painting just to see what it's like.
I mean, I remember the nurse coming in there and I lifted up my mask and I went, hey there. And she's like, hi, Michael. And I'm like, what are you doing? And she's like, we're moving this chair. And I'm like, why are you doing that? She's like, oh, we need to get ready for another patient. And by this, I'm balls deep in this trip. And I'm like, am I okay? And she goes, you're great. And I go, how's my resting heart rate? She's like, it's perfect. It's perfect. And I go, thank you. And she goes, Have a nice day, Michael. And she walked out. She looked like a cartoon character. And then I closed my mask. And then I went on board, got back on board, and tripped out. Dude, it was
how's
insane.
My resting heart rate?
I swear to God, I asked her, how's my resting heart rate? And like, am I doing okay? You're doing great. Anyway, look, for those last few minutes, I want to talk to you just about Supernatural. We've talked about, I thank you for being so open. And so, look, I feel like I know you more now. And I feel like people who, like, when they go to conventions and stuff, I don't know if you've ever gotten this deep. You ever talk about this stuff?
Probably not all at once, but.
Well, I appreciate you for being so open, and I hope I didn't upset you by saying anything.
Right. No, it's all right. I'll just book a double appointment with my therapist.
Do you go to therapy?
Not really. Very occasionally. I should.
Are you only saying that because you're running for office?
I'm one of those people that I'm always thinking to myself, I should do more therapy. I have a therapist who I've spoken with 3 times. So it's a start.
That's a start. Supernatural. So you've been on it all 10 years?
Supernatural is going into its 15th season. Not to correct
you. Oh, sorry. 15. That's what I meant. Rob, what the fuck?
I've been on, this will be my 12th season.
Yeah, when I hear your name, people say, I think it was Mark Shepard who said, they throw so much at him. Like, you're the guy who has all the dialogue. Like, a lot of the big dialogue. Is that true?
No. It's actually on the contrary. They often use me as a glorified extra because they don't like how I deliver my lines, is my assumption. Mark, it's funny, Mark actually, when he was on the show, he had these really beastly, big, meaty chunks of dialogue. And he has this lovely kind of lyrical, maybe it's just because he's from the UK and,
everything and sounds good.
They have an unfair advantage, but you know, there's maybe there's like Shakespeare in his blood or something like that. But he had this knack for even though often he couldn't really remember his lines, when he finally got them, they just sounded, it just was lyrical. Mark would often have these long soliloquies when he was on the show, which was lovely. But I've been, you know, they keep me busy, but I'm often sort of monosyllabic.
Do you ever get to a point where you're like, you had to, because we all have. But where, you know, you're working, you're now in your sixth season at this point. You know, I know you've done 12 seasons, but have you ever thought, you know, at the sixth season, you're like, oh, my God, I'm saying the same stuff, or I'm doing this, or there's times where, like, I just want to go do something else, or were you always, like, it's easy to say, no, I'm happy. I want everybody to know how happy I was and perfect. I mean, life's great because you're human. So you're going to go through stages of, like, okay, I've kind of had enough. Did you ever get through that?
There's definitely moments when I wake up. I mean, you know, from Smallville, the schedule can be bruising. The idea of waking up and, you know, I live quite a long ways away from set. And, you know, I often have to get up at 4:30 in the morning to get to work. And then, you know, by the end of the week, we're shooting until 4 o'clock in the morning. And it's kind of exhausting. And sometimes I don't want to go to work. But one of the things that makes our show great is that it feels like it's never repetition. We're always doing something different. The characters, I mean, my character, I played the human that my angel possessed. I played my angel when he first came on the show and was just a servant of God. I played Lucifer. I became insane. I became a human angel. I had amnesia. I was this weird being with a strange accent who was keeper of the empty. I was a weird Nazi iteration of myself with a quasi-German accent in a parallel universe. Like, we are constantly shifting the terrain under our feet and making it kind of interesting. So, I've worn pretty much the same costume for 12 years. And there is some stuff that starts to feel a little bit redundant, but for the most part, this is not, you know, a procedural drama where we're interviewing perp number two in the witness room every week. We're kind of doing weird new stuff all the time. We're breaking the fourth wall. I played Misha, the actor who played Castiel on the TV show Supernatural. natural. Like, we do enough weird shit that it kind of does make it feel fresh. That was a factor that went into the decision to end the show, was, you know, conversations about like, well, we could stretch this storyline for another 3 years, or we could go out with a bang and have one great final season. And everyone was like, you know what? That sounds like the right choice. Let's not go out with a whimper. Let's go out with a bang. So I really am genuinely not bored. Sometimes I don't want to go to work, but it doesn't feel like a drag.
Right. So you go there, your attitude pretty much is like, hey, I'm getting paid to act probably a lot, and it's fun, and I love the people I work with, and it's a success, and it makes an impact on so many lives that, you know, it makes you get up and enjoy life a little more.
I mean, miraculously, all of those things that you just said are true. We really do love working together. Our crew is incredible. We have a great working dynamic. We do get to do very strange stuff on the show, which is exhilarating and satisfying. We do get paid more than we should be paid, and yet it's remarkable. But you can still go into that set of circumstances and be like, ugh, I don't want to go to work. I think we humans have this incredible capacity to be dissatisfied with wherever we are.
Yeah, that's so true. You know, Shepard might have said this instead. Maybe I got it wrong because it was a while ago, that he said that maybe they fuck with you the most.
Oh, that's right.
Okay, that's right. Yes. They fuck with you the most. So, that's what it is.
For the last 3 years, we've had a new actor on the show, Alex Calvert, who looks like me 20 years ago. He looks like my son. And it's been a real breath of fresh air because Jared and Jensen have taken him as they've started hazing him instead of hazing me. So I have gotten a little bit of a reprieve from the abuse. But it was interesting for me to notice, this is another thing to sort of notice about yourself. For a long time, Jared and Jensen would make it really difficult. When it was all three of us on set, they would invariably fuck with me. Right below frame, where the camera couldn't see, where the director couldn't see what was going on. You know, Jared would be, you know, he would have a broomstick in my crotch while it was my coverage. And I would just be like biting my cheeks and trying to muscle through it and, you know, cursing them. Then Alex came on the show and they started doing the same thing to him. And I just jumped on the bandwagon. I was like, thank God it's not me. And it was a good thing to learn about myself, that it wasn't that I had any kind of moral compass or anything. I just didn't want to be the one getting abused. And I was happy to throw someone else under the bus. So now I just join in with making it difficult for him to work. And it feels like everything is right in the universe.
Does, you know, being around a family like that, I know it's you hang out with these people more than you do with your own family, probably, or most of your family, except your immediate family. There's so much laughter, there's so much love. But do you ever see other emotions? Do you ever see any anger? Do you ever see any real sadness? Do you ever have to take care of each other in that regard? Because it can't always be pretty.
Oh, yeah. I mean, particularly, you know, me, Jared, Jensen, you know what? That's not really even true. I think even the recurring characters, you know, we've all been working together for so long and we've all gone through difficult things. You know, there've been divorces and bouts of depression and difficult chapters in everyone's life. And we have definitely been there for one another in those times. And, you know, I mean, we've had times when we've just sort of had our arms around one another in our trailers and, you know, patted one another's backs and said, hey, you know, we're here for you. We love you. And it is really nice to feel like we have that support network at work. I mean, we're friends, we're coworkers. We drive each other crazy. It really does, in a lot of ways, look and feel like a family. It's got all of the emotional texture of a family.
What do you think the emotions are going to be the last day on set for you? You probably don't even know.
No, I think we all have probably a taste of it. I mean, just making the announcement that we were ending the show was a little bit of a glimpse into what that's going to feel like. It's certainly going to, everyone's going to be crying. It's going to be a shit show in that department. I don't know how they're going to actually shoot anything on that final day. Yeah. But I think that there is a bittersweetness to it because it is, you know, it's been a really long chapter in all of our lives, and it'll be an exciting moment to look forward to a new future where we don't know what's coming down the pipe. You know, new adventures will come our way. And I think we're all looking forward to that in some respects, and we're all really going to miss the show. And the show's not going to ever go away for us. It's always going to be a part of our lives. You were on Smallville the whole
7 years.
Run,
right?
7 years?
I left after seven and came back for the season finale. Series finale.
That, I mean, you, so you know kind of that feeling.
Yeah, we did 22 years, so I did about 160 episodes.
That's
and,
a huge...
You know, for me, it was time to go. Yeah, it was huge. It was, oh my God, and I cried. I didn't think I would. And I cried when I left. I hugged my makeup artist, Natalie, and I said, all right, well, good scene. And then, oh, Jesus. And it was just floodgates. Because it is. She's like, she was a mother to me. She listened to me. Unlike my real mother. She did, though. She really listened to me, and I knew her family, and I would remember. I remember stories that I tell about, to tell this day, about her kid. And I remember some stupid story. She comes home at 2 in the morning. We're filming so late, and she comes home, and she's getting to bed. And her husband goes, hey, Natalie, little Blake wants to talk to you. He wants you to wake him up. He has to tell you something very important. And she's like, it's like 2:30 in the morning, honey. I'm so touched. She's like, he's saying, no, I promised him that you'd wake him up. She's like, okay. And so she goes into little Blake's room, and she shakes him. She goes, Blake, huh? Blake, yeah. Dad said you wanted me to wake you up. You had something really important to tell me. I threw up today. Just went back to bed. But I just remember I was so captivated by her stories and her family, and I was interested. And, you know, it was so sad that when I went, I was like, these people I'll rarely see again, if at all, if ever. I can remember their names. And it's like, especially, you know, 12 years for you, it's almost twice that much in these guys. So at the end, I imagine that they're going to need, Kleenex is going to probably sponsor the final episode for Supernatural.
Yeah, we could get a good sponsorship there.
Well, dude, I appreciate you. I'm going to talk to your other buddies today. And
all right.
This is the most we've talked.
Yeah. It's been mostly pleasant.
Yeah, it has. It really has. I really enjoyed you, Misha Collins. Thank you for allowing me to be inside of you.
I enjoyed you being in me, and I hope we get to spend more time in each other.
I cannot wait, my friend. I cannot wait. Good luck with the final season, man.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye.
Don't be nice to Jared and Jensen, please.
Never. Oh, my God. Hey, guys. Thanks for listening to Misha Collins. Right now, as I promised, Left on Laurel. This is track 2. Please check out the album. Buy it. Spread the word. Go to Left on Laurel on all social media platforms and merchandise is on inside of you. You can get a lot of great stuff. This one is called The 10. All the trophies on my shelf, I still can't take a look at myself. I am winning. You told me time and time again that you were just looking for me. I got half a tank of gas, I'm on the 10 now, east and out of sight.
Welcome to Talkville,
the ultimate Smallville rewatch podcast. Guest star Sarah Carter as Alicia Baker.
Although I didn't really work with her a lot.
But Tom did, and they had some real big smoochy scenes.
Yeah. Should we talk about that?
Could there be any more sex? What was a 3-page makeout scene that just kept going? Good Lord. We get it. They have chemistry.
Jump in now or catch up on any of the past seasons of Talkville on YouTube or wherever you listen.